briefly summarize
the main point of yesterday's lecture,
which is essentially what we studied was the very strong constraints imposed by the fact that we're studying theories that have a very large symmetry, which is a conformal symmetry. On correlation functions of primaries. Because remember, the primaries are the basic operators of the CFT from which everything else, from which all the other ones can be derived by taking derivatives. And essentially what we found is that for the one-point function, we found that the one-point function of an operator vanishes unless O delta is the identity operator. And then we fixed, and we showed that the two and three-point function of primaries have their position dependence is uniquely fixed. So and it's fixed in terms of the dimensions of the primaries. But this guy, well, the two-point function is not, the normalization of the two-point function is not that interesting because it's just an overall normalization. But the coefficient of the three-point function is something physical. So in particular, we care about, one of the things that we're going to care about well, so here, this x dependence that we described. I'm not going to write it again. And here we have some coefficients, C1, 2, 3, that we must determine. It's part of the, depends on the details of the CFT. And then we saw that for 4-point and higher, the position dependence is not uniquely fixed because there are coordinates, these cross ratios, which are invariant under conformal transformations, any of the conformal transformations. So now correlators are functions of cross ratios. Which remember, there are two for the 4-point, and it's essentially distances like that, so the distance between 1 and 2 times the distance of 3, 4 times the distance of 1, 3 times the distance of 2, 4. And then there is another independent one where now the distance is between 1 and 4. And here the distance is between 2 and 3. Okay? And the other thing I showed you, maybe a bit fast at the end, but is essentially I gave you the tools that if you really wanted, you would be able to compute the position dependence, say, for the 2 and 3-point function. For higher, you can also do it, but actually that's kind of the it's harder. In fact, the formula for the formula for the 3-point function of stress tensors, the complete form, all the tensors that you can get, all the invariant tensors that you can get on the right-hand side of the correlator, I think it's a problem that has only been solved, say, in the last 10 years. Not because it's very hard, because somehow people were not asking the right question. But the point I made is that all the correlation functions so we already showed that the correlation function has two pieces. One that is kind of a scalar piece, which is the denominator. And then there is a tensor piece, which goes in the numerator. And we can construct the tensor piece of the correlator using two basic objects. this matrix XI that depends on 2 points, which you have played with a lot. Something like delta mu minus 2x mu x mu over x squared. And remember that we have an interpretation of a kind of a parallel transport. It's a tensor that allows you to move from here to here. And yeah, so that was tensor one. And then something more exotic that I briefly described is that in order to construct the most general thing, we'll need one other tensor, which has as its input now not 2 points, but 3 points. So let me write the correct formula. And so I have here x mu, y mu, x mu. And associated to any 3 points in spacetime, I can associate 3 coordinates. I call it capital Z mu to distinguish it from the small Z mu, which is made out of these 3 coordinates. And I wrote down explicitly what it was. It was something like X minus Z mu, X minus Z square, minus Y minus Z mu, X minus Y minus Z square. And I could have constructed an analog coordinate for X mu and Y mu, where I permute the little x, y's, and z's, okay? And now by pairing these guys together and knowing how the left-hand side transforms under Lorentz transformations, which is, so for tensor representations, these are things that are made out of multiplying vectors together, you can cook up the tensor that has to appear on the right-hand side. And we made an example. I mean, an important example is that of the stress tensor, which I said is the basic operator of any CFT, and where we said that there's a constant C, which we will have much to talk about in 2 dimensions in the next few lectures. Oh, it's also interesting in higher dimensions, but so I don't know how you call this. Let's call it alpha mu nu rho sigma, and this divided by x minus y. And since the dimension of the stress tensor, we said that it's as D, so you get this. And what we showed is that the form of this tensor is uniquely fixed by the property that it's a scale invariant, and it has the symmetry properties of the stress tensor. It transforms in the same way that the left-hand side transforms. And the way we did it was by putting together, so let me write, as a function of x, was 1/2 I mu rho of x. Now it symmetrizes. And then I have to remove the trace. And in principle, with enough effort, you would be able to do it for any tensor. Yes?
It's not supposed to be any sort of partial
differentiation. No,
it's
no. This is
just the symmetry. Sorry.
This is just a statement that you have something that eats two things and expels two things. Yes?
That pi mu, should it be a delta mu or a metric?
Oh, that depends on whether you're Euclidean or Lorentzian. So
the general should be the metric.
So, yeah, I'm going through it a little bit in Euclidean and Lorentzian, but yeah, it's magic. Okay, so enough of that, maybe. So somehow we've reached almost the boundary of what can be said about higher dimensional field, conformal field theories without getting into explicit constructions of higher dimensional conformal field theories. And so in this course, we'll essentially now move directly to not studying 4-dimensional CFTs, which what we'll leave 4 dimensions, but more directly to 2 dimensions, because Well, first of all, they're directly applicable to the real-world physics. We already discussed that in terms of critical phenomena and quantum phase transitions. But also it's because it's the place where the symmetries of the theory will allow us to solve it completely. So the study of higher-dimensional conformal field theories, that's something that now you're ready to tackle it if you want. You have the basic tools. And I just conclude now this discussion of four-dimensional conformal field theories by just giving you kind of a few examples of the kind of CFTs that we know in four dimensions. And hopefully at least one of them you will study in your, I don't know how it's called, the resumation course, or the other course that you're having right now. The point is that the reason it's hard to construct conformal field theories, as I explained in the first lecture, is that quantum corrections tend to induce running on the coupling. So if something is, you can have many theories that are classically conformal invariant, but it's broken by quantum effects. So that's something from this point of view, this is kind of a problem, because it's hard to find theories that will be exactly conformal invariant. But there are several, so let me show you a couple of ways in which you can cook up CFTs. One way, which was very ingenious, is called Wilson-Fisher fixed points. Here the idea sounds bizarre. And the motivation of this here is that they were trying to study critical phenomena in our world, which is three spatial dimensions. And so these are described by three-dimensional quantum field theories. But the idea that they had is that they wanted to find a fixed point by starting with some lambda phi to the fourth theory and generalizations of that, which have O(n) symmetry, where instead of just having a single scalar field, you have n copies of the scalar field. But all the indices of the fields are contracted in a symmetric way, so you have O(n) symmetry. And essentially, what they did is to identify a fixed point of renormalization group. So remember that a conformal field theory, as I stressed many times, is a fixed point of the renormalization group. By studying the theory, not in four dimensions, but in four minus epsilon dimensions. So you have now a new expansion parameter, which is epsilon. And the basic idea is this. So if you go to four minus epsilon dimensions, remember that in four dimensions, the coupling of lambda phi to the fourth is dimensionless, classically dimensionless. But if you go to four minus epsilon, you give it a small mass dimension, just by doing the dimensional analysis that we've been doing, okay? So this means that if you look at the beta function of this theory in four minus epsilon dimensions, classically, you got zero before here because it's scaling invariant, but now it has a small piece, so let me just write it something like minus epsilon. This is just the fact that now we're studying this theory not in four, but in four minus epsilon dimensions. And then you have the one loop contribution. Which you have studied in your field theory course. And remember that the one loop contribution of a scalar field theory has a positive beta function. This is a statement that the coupling constant becomes weak as you go to very large distances. So you get something here that is C, so some positive number, the beta function is positive, times some power of lambda. I think it's square, but doesn't matter for this argument. And what they did is essentially compensate. In order to get a zero here, they essentially canceled this guy with this guy. Okay, so from here you can get a non-trivial fixed point, lambda star, which is just a solution of this equation. And then what they did is study very carefully the dependence of the critical exponents, like the various correlation functions in this theory, at the fixed point. And from this, as I explained in the beginning of the course, from the anomalous dimensions of, from the dimensions of the of your operators in your field theory, you can extract you can extract the critical exponents. And actually, by doing something that looks crazy, and that's where Carl Bender hopefully will explain, actually what they did is they resummed the perturbation series and took epsilon to equals 1, which sounds nuts, but it works. And then they compared with the experiment, it worked beautifully. So that's one kind of way in which you can get fixed points, just by essentially being clever and shifting your dimension in a way that the beta function contribution at one loop is canceled by the three-level contribution, and you get a fixed point. Okay, that's one example. Oh, sorry, yes. Before, I think.
Actually, before. Before, okay, so maybe, okay. The notation you're using is suggestive.
Yes, but actually here, the point is that there is kind of a fake. I mean, in measurement relation, you think of epsilon as just a regulator. Right. Here, they really want to take epsilon to 1, and it's a physical dimension that you're interested in.
Right.
But I do think it was before measurement relation.
But all the, I guess all the formulas they would have worked out, maybe that's what inspired the whole idea.
You should ask too.
Yeah.
I think it's coming soon again, so we should ask. Any more questions? Historical or not historical? I don't know much about history, but I'll try. Another example that is kind of, there's another example that I'm not going to describe in detail, which is kind of, is based on the same ideology, is that, so here we're going to three dimensions from starting from 4. There's a way of going from to 4 dimensions, to 3 dimensions starting from 2. And there what you do is you study in two dimensions. So here we started in D equals 4. Here we start in D equals 2. And you study what's called the nonlinear sigma model. So this is a theory that has a Lagrangian like that. It's made out of a whole bunch of scalar fields. So this is not a metric of a space-time. It's a metric on the space of fields. As we know, in two dimensions, the theory is classically, I mean, in two dimensions, the scalar field has classically 0 dimension. So this guy is classically scale invariant, conformal invariant, just like lambda phi to the 4 is classically conformal invariant. But now, something that's very nice is that this theory actually, if I elaborate more, which I won't, has at one loop has a non-trivial beta function also. Almost all theories in the world have a non-trivial beta function. But one crucial difference now is that the beta function has a negative sign, just like Young-Mills theory. So if you remember from your course, in a way, there are two types of, the beta function can either be positive or negative, or it can be 0, in fact. But the point is that when it's negative, it's called asymptotically free. So now what they did, so now this sign will be negative, right? So now if you want to get a 0 of the beta function, what you have to do is to extrapolate to 2 plus epsilon dimensions. Because now this leading term will be plus epsilon, and this term will be negative, and you can get a 0, okay? So that's also a game that people have played a lot with. The other one that is slightly different, but it has the same ideology. This is just to show you that it's hard to get, unless you put extra symmetries to get a non-trivial fixed point. What you can study is the Young-Mills theories with matter of the type you've studied. And there you know that the beta function of the gauge coupling, so remember this G is the strength, interaction strength of 3 gluons. Here, what you find is that the beta function at one loop is negative. Let me write the correct powers. So now you can try to do something a bit wacky and compensate the one loop running of the beta function with the two loop running of the beta function. This is one loop higher than this because you get an extra power of g squared. And remember that g squared is like h bar. So this is one loop. This is what's called two loop. Hopefully you have seen this. Hopefully you have not seen this. You don't want to see this, really? I mean, it's horrible. And now the idea is that you can tune your matter content. So remember that the matter fields in your theory contribute. Matter fields like to make the beta function positive. Gauge fields like to make the beta function negative. And by tuning the matter content, you can choose beta naught and beta 1 to be positive in such a way that you get a solution like that. So that G at the fixed point is something like B0 over B1. And by tuning B0 and B1, you can make this much smaller than 1. So this is a fixed point that's perturbative because the value of the coupling at the fixed point is small. And you can use perturbation theory. And these theories are this kind of fixed point, which is essentially just copy-paste of the same ideology there. Sometimes they're called banks, Zach's fixed points, okay? And this essentially is the list of theory. I mean, you can use the same tricks in a slightly different theory, but this is essentially the list. So in order to get a large class of conformal field theories, something that's that you can do in order to tame. So notice that this running is induced by the fact that you have quantum effects that induce this running. One way you can tame that is by try to cancel the effects at very short distances from various degrees of freedom. And that's what supersymmetry does. So there is an infinite class of supersymmetric gauge theories that have the property that they're exactly conformal. And the simplest example being has this funny name, n equals 4 superangles, okay, which you'll study in your ADS-CFT course. And in fact, many of these supersymmetric conformal gauge theories that these theories, the reason they're also interesting, apart from that they're explicit constructions of conformal field theories in four dimensions, they have a dual description in terms of ADS-5 quantum gravity. Asymptotically ADS-5 quantum gravity. So in fact, many of the theories of the conformal field theories that we know have a concrete ADS-CFT dual that also you will study, hopefully, in your in ADS-CFT. And so I think you have a course on supersymmetry later on in the year. You should ask who is it? Perry, Malcolm Perry, to construct for you some examples of conformal gauge theories, supersymmetric conformal gauge theories. So now we will abandon four dimensions and go to two dimensions. In any case, critical phenomenon in two dimensions, that's something that has been observed in nature. Supersymmetry is not something that has been observed in nature. And in any case, if it's there, it's in any case spontaneously broken. So not only we're going to two dimensions for practical reasons, it's also directly relevant for nature. And we will see that there we will be able to do many, many things that will be very hard to do in higher dimensions. I should say that also there are many interesting CFTs in three dimensions, which also have ADS duals. And you should ask whoever teaches that course to tell you about that. Okay, any questions about this? Because now we're going to kind of turn page and go to two dimensions. Very good. So now we're going to start our study of two-dimensional. Conformal field theories, which is an incredibly rich subject. Let me remind you a little bit that this is describes critical phenomena in two dimensions, like the critical point of the Isaac model, It describes quantum critical behavior. In one space dimension. So this, here the prototype was the Ising model, the two-dimensional Ising model. Here the prototype that we will study the CFT description of would be the Heisenberg spin chain. And the last important application, which actually goes hand in hand with this development, kind of conformal filters are very interesting. It's kind of arose in the intersection of string theory and kind of this application in condensed matter theory. And it had kind of a rich interplay of ideas between the two fields. But the other important application of two-dimensional conformal field theories is as the description of relativistic string theory. Which you'll also have a course on that, so I will not say any further. That. Okay. So now we're in two dimensions. So when in two dimensions, it's very nice to use complex analysis because we can do many, we can compute, for example, many integrals using complex analysis that are hard to do in the real variable. So we will use the complex language. So we're in two dimensions. So we have two coordinates, x1 and x2. And we will define complex coordinate z. X1 plus X2. So before we get into all this fun stuff, we still have to develop some machinery, and then we'll be able to have fun applications. It's like a roller coaster ride. You have to go up before you go down. So now it's still going up a little bit, and soon enough, we'll be doing all kinds of applications. Okay. So we'll use, instead of X1 and X2, we'll use these complex coordinates. And I'll just tell you some trivial formulas. We'll define the derivative with respect to z is given by this. So it has the property that d dz adding on z is 0, right? And the, oh, sorry, equals 1. And it has the property that dz of z bar equals 0. And therefore, dz bar is just the complex conjugate. Okay. So now we want to go back to our equation for conformal transformations. I want to express it in terms of complex coordinate. I briefly did that in one of the lectures. But remember that the equation was that if we make an infinitesimal transformation, what we have to analyze is this equation. Sorry. V mu equals 2 over D delta mu. No. So I'm going to be mostly in Euclidean space. But notice that in two space dimensions, this guy is just 1. So now you can just evaluate all the possible equations here, and you get two independent equations. You get that E1, B1 equals E2, B2, and E1, B2 equals minus E2, B1, which we already said are the Cauchy-Riemann equation. Now, we can write this in complex notation by defining some complex vector field, B1 plus IB2. And then the conformal transformations are nothing but the statement that are those generated by a vector field V, which is holomorphic. So those two equations are equivalent to this equation. So conformal transformations are in one-to-one correspondence with holomorphic maps, holomorphic transformations. So these are maps that depend on Z, but not on Z bar. That's what this equation is telling us. And, but of course, the set of solutions of this equation is infinite dimensional, because the space of holomorphic transformations is infinite dimensional. So you get an infinite dimensional set of conformal transformations in two dimensions. This is very different to the case in higher dimensions where the number of conformal generators, the solutions of the conformal Killing vector equation, was something like this. In two dimensions, you get this infinite family. So now what we can do is we can parameterize a holomorphic single valued transformation as this. So we have Z that goes to Z tilde, Z plus dz. And now we take this V just to be a Lorentz series. So you take something, V is anything that's single valued. So the sum from n to infinity to minus infinity of Zn. This is a basis of this transformation, right? Zn, Z to the n. This doesn't look the same letter. So this is the most general single value vector field that's holomorphic. And these Cns are the analog of our parameters for translations, rotations, dilatations, and special conformal transformations. But now we have an infinite number of them. So now we want to study, just like we studied the algebra of the vector fields. Is there someone in Skype there? It's interesting. Oh. So just like we studied the algebra of the vector fields in higher dimensions to discover the conformal algebra, now we want to study the algebra of the vector fields of single-valued holomorphic maps or holomorphic vector fields. And that's very easy. So we defined, in complete analogy with what we did before, we defined, we call it Ln. So this is the vector field associated to a particular basis element of the transformation. We can also define the complex conjugate. And now we want to study the algebra that these vector fields generate. This will be the conformal algebra in two dimensions. So by now we know how to do this extremely well. So you take Lm, and you have the commutator of vector fields. So all that you really have to do is put a test function here, arbitrary test function here, and just take derivatives. It's completely straightforward. And what you get is that this is n minus m of L of n plus m. You get exactly the same kind of equation. For the anti-holomorphic vector fields. And you can easily show, well, it's obvious that Ln commutes with Ln bar. So essentially what this is telling us is that the conformal algebra generated by these vector fields in two dimensions are two copies, because you have two commuting copies, because you have Ln and an L bars, and they don't talk to each other. So this implies that the conformal algebra is kind of the direct sum of the algebra generated by the Ln's and the algebra generated by L bar n's. And this algebra is sometimes called the width. Later on, when we study quantum physics, I mean, right now we're just doing kinematics, we'll notice that there is a very important modification due to quantum effects to this algebra. Maybe I can tell you a little bit what will be. So later we will see. I'm mentioning this because you might have heard the word Virasoro algebra, and I want to tell you what the difference between the Virasoro algebra and the DeWitt algebra is. So once we study, actually, the kind of conformal symmetry algebra that we're going to get in an actual physical system will be the Virasoro algebra. And for that, we usually, I'll try to use, if I remember, capital L's to distinguish it. So the first part will look exactly the same. And the only difference is that you get an extra term on the right-hand side that's compatible with the Jacobi identity, of course. And you get something like C over 12, something like n squared minus 1. So you get a term that's only there if m equals minus m, okay? And this C is called the central charge of the CFT. And it's kind of an important part of the DNA of the theory, yes?
I
allow poles. So we allow the most general transformation, the single value. So you can have. Okay, so to be precise, I will call it meromorphic. Because we allow poles as the origin. That's a good question. Yeah. So this is the representation. So this is the algebra that we'll have to study a representation theory of, because that's what you get in an actual CFT. The central chart is, as I said, is a part of the DNA of the theory. And not surprisingly, that's why I went through this sang and done. You can show that this C that appears here is going to be exactly the same C that appears in the two-point function of the stress tensor. So that, and we will hopefully show that. We will definitely show that. Okay, so I just mentioned this because if people have heard the word Virasoro, I want to make sure that we are all saying the same thing. Okay, so this was arbitrary single value transformations. But now these transformations are not all globally defined. So only a subset of them are globally defined on the Riemann sphere, which means the complex plane. So we're studying in two dimensions. So we have the complex plane. And to the complex plane, you can add a point at infinity. And that defines the Riemann sphere. So now what we want to study are what are the vector fields that are non-singular on the Riemann sphere. These guys play an important role. And the picture you should have, I mean, if you haven't seen this before, don't worry about it. If you've seen it, maybe this will help. Remember that you can, if I give you a two-sphere, I can map the two-sphere to the complex plane by a stereographic projection, where you pick a north pole on the sphere, and you project any point on the sphere to the complex plane by just projecting down towards the plane. And the reason that this, you can think of the two-sphere as this, the complex plane plus a point at infinity, is that notice that the north pole in this stereographic projection is mapped to infinity. Okay. So this is the Riemann sphere. And now we want to study which ones are non-singular here. So let's look at our vector fields, Ln. So first, what are the dangerous points? The dangerous points are obviously the origin here and infinity, which I don't know how to draw. Well, I can draw it here. So you can have something nasty happening either at the north pole or the south pole. So let's study which ones are non-singular. So let's consider first the, if you wish, the south pole, which is near z equals 0. So clearly, ln is non-singular if n is bigger than minus 1. Right? If n was smaller than minus 1, you would have a 1 over z factor here, and you would have a problem. So this is not a globally defined vector field near z equals 0. And now let's look at z equals infinity. You could think of this as the south pole in this picture, north. And this is the north pole. And now here we have to do some trivial, in order to study whether the vector field is singular, we change coordinates. We define w is 1 over z. So I just write this as minus omega of minus n plus 1. And now here I have dw, dz, dw. So from here I get minus 1 over z squared, which written in terms of w is w squared. So I get plus omega of minus n minus 1 ddw. So now this is singular. Which ones are non-singular at infinity, which is near w equals 0? Are the ones where n minus 1 is negative. Did you get the sense right? Hopefully. So that means that, and notice that this transformation is just another way of thinking about this. If you know this, great. If not, don't worry. Is that in order to describe the two sphere, you need two coordinate patches. You need a coordinate patch near the south pole and a coordinate patch near the north pole. And these two coordinate patches are related by exactly this transformation. Okay, that's all we're doing. So from this we conclude that the globally defined vector fields are essentially L0, L1, and L minus 1, which is the intersection of this condition and this condition. So now, what are these guys? What are these guys? We will recognize them immediately, given our experience with the conformal transformations in higher dimensions. So let's study what they do. So let's here look at an infinitesimal transformation. And here the finite transformation. So L minus 1 just is obviously a translation, right? Because, yeah, so here. So if n equals minus 1, the vector field is just ddz, which is just a shift. It acts on z as a shift, so just a translation. And the finite translation is just the same, essentially. So this we should think of as essentially a translation. Then we have L0, so now instead of just getting a translation, we get actually, okay, and the finite transformation will be something like that. It will be simple. And here, what are we doing? We're doing two things. We're doing a scale transformation. Lambda, actually, here is complex. Lambda can be a complex number. Plus a rotation. And we'll see more explicitly why this is. I mean, I think it should be pretty clear because by doing this transformation, I can either change the magnitude of the right-hand side because the magnitude of lambda is different from 1, but I also change the phase because lambda is a complex number. It has a phase, so it changes the phase of z tilde. And then we have L1. Notice that we're going up in our the in the polynomial dependence of the vector field on the coordinates. And this guy is quadratic. So here, the finite transformation is, as usual, nasty, or a bit nasty. Not. And this is kind of the model analog of the special conformal transformations. Okay. So we see that the globally defined vector fields are exactly the ones which are at most quadratic in the coordinates, which were precisely the vector fields that we had in higher dimensions. So you should think of the globally defined vector fields in two dimensions as exactly the same way as the conformal transformation in higher dimensions. They're exactly the same set. They have the same restriction on to be at most quadratic in the coordinates. And by now you should be able to guess what is the algebra generated by these vector fields. Just from our knowledge in higher dimensions. So some statements I'm going to make is that you can combine this transformation in a package them in a nice way. You can think of them as a map from Z to Z tilde, which takes this form. This sometimes is called a fractional linear transformation. So you take Z, and you just make a ratio of two monomials, like that, with the constraint. And where in this language, A, B, C, D. OK, so here A, B, C, and D are complex numbers that satisfy the property that A, D minus B, C equals 1. And now this defines, if you think of this as a matrix, so you can package this ABCD as a 2x2 matrix. The matrices, the space, the set of matrices, 2x2 matrices with complex entries that have this property. Have people seen this before? I mean, these are called the SL2C. Matrices. So these are matrices that have complex entries and have unit determinants. And that's called SL2C. And now you can very easily show that, indeed, a conformal transformation can be always written in this form. Okay? And another way of saying this, to connect with our discussions of the orthogonal group of the conformal, the representation of the conformal group in terms of orthogonal transformations, this guy is the same as, up to some global identification that we're not going to care about now, is the same as SO13, which, remember, should ring a bell, because we already said that in the conformal group, the conformal algebra in D dimensions, I showed you that it could be repackaged by combining P's and K's and so on into Euclidean notations. Okay, I guess to be consistent with that, let me write it like this. It could be written like that. So what we're finding indeed is that the global transformations are just indeed follow the same pattern as in higher dimensions. Any questions about this?
Nothing might happen. I mean, but now instead of talking about holomorphic vector fields, you talk about right moving and left moving. Because what happens is that the. Sorry, go ahead. So, very Lorentzian. We have light cones. And you have two basic light cones, x plus and x minus. You can think of x plus and minus as something like, say x0 plus minus x1. So now we're in Euclidean, in Lorentzian signature. So the statement of conformal fields now is that you have to look at vector fields
that are only functions of B plus or only functions of B minus. And as you know from waves, if you have a function which is a function of only of X plus or X minus, it means that you're describing a wave that travels at the speed of light, number one. And number two, that depending on whether moves like that or like that, it's kind of a right mover or left mover, left moving wave. But other than that, not much happens. There are subtleties with conformal theory in higher genus in Lorentzian signature, but I think that's we can postpone that. But so mostly I'll be discussing the language of in Euclidean signature, because complex analysis you can do almost everything I do in Lorentzian signature, but it's very useful to think in terms of complex analysis because we know complex analysis. Okay. So now the point is that we can write, okay, by the way, so here I always keep dropping the anti-holomorphic ones, which are also there. And now essentially from this construction, what you should be able to show, and this will be an exercise for the tutorial, you should be able to show that there is a nice map between Ln and L bar n. For n equals minus 1, 0, and 1. And the conformal generators that we've been discussing. So p mu, m mu nu. In two dimensions, there is only one Lorentz generator, right? In two dimensions, you only have rotations. So if you wish, okay, let me write it like that. So you have one rotation. Now mu and nu goes between only 1 and 2. Then we have the dilatation, and then we have the special conformal transformation. So you should be able to, by comparing the vector fields here with the vector fields I've written here, you should be able to find a one-to-one map between these lens and the more familiar, hopefully, conformal generator. One last thing I want to say about this before moving forward is that let's look in a bit more detail, just to get some intuition of what's going on here, at the algebra generated by the global ones. So let's look at the commutator of L0, L1, and L minus 1. I think I can erase this. Is there some other blackboard? So let's look at the algebra of L0, L1, L minus 1. So let's write a very, just from, can you see that up there, hopefully? The first line. So here what you have is that L0, L1 is minus L1. L0, L minus 1 is L minus 1. And then L1, L minus 1 is 2L0. Does this remind you of anything? Yes. So you can see that this is essentially the SU2 there is some subtlety, but yeah, so. And you can see it by just making identification that J3 equals L0, the familiar J minus, which is a lowering operator of angular momentum, which is J1 minus IJ2, which is IL1, and J plus, which is the raising operator, that's the one that moves you, changes the azimuthal quantum number of your particle. And here I want to get this sign right, which is IL minus 1. And the reason, okay, it doesn't matter. So it would be SU2, exactly SU2, if here, essentially, the precise way of saying it is that this algebra is not SU2. Remember that SU2 is the same thing as SO3. The precise statement is that this guy is kind of has an I, extra I somewhere, that makes this into SO1,2. Okay. But for our purposes, essentially this L0, L1, and L-1 satisfy an SU2 algebra. Any questions about this? So now we want to start understanding conformal fields in this theory, in two dimensions. So let's say a few things. In two dimensions, there's also something else that is, makes life easier. So let me describe it. So I'm already going to answer part of the problem here of identifying LNs with the usual conformal generators. So let's look. Remember that when we specified the conformal field, we had to specify two quantum numbers of the field or the operator. We have to specify its Lorentz quantum numbers. That was that funny matrix appearing all over the place. And we have to specify the dimension of the operator. Essentially, the eigenvalues or the transformation properties under Lorentz and the dilatation operator. So, as I said, in two dimensions, there's only one possible rotation you can have, right? So you have M12. Let's call it just M. So in terms of L0, it's just L0 minus L0 bar. And the reason you can convince yourself of this is that this is nothing but minus I Z dZ minus Z bar dZ bar. This guy is nothing but writing the usual rotation formula in terms of x1 and x2 in complex coordinates. And this makes a lot of sense because it says that if you perform a rotation, the phase of z changes by positive number. Well, this means that the phase of z bar changes in the opposite direction. Okay? And that's how rotations act. And the other important guy is the dilatation operator, d, which is the sum of L0 plus L0 bar, which in terms of coordinate is just Z dZ plus Z bar dZ bar, which is just the statement that if I make a dilatation, I just rescale in exactly the same way Z and Z bar, okay? Yes?
So earlier you were talking about how you get the SO13 algebra. That's from the bar and not bar
yes.
generators. Okay.
Yes.
And then the not bar only generators give you
yes.
SO12.
Yes. The point is that morally speaking, SO13 is like SU2 times SU2.
Conformal transformations that we're familiar with from higher dimensions.
Yes. And also, by the way, this SO1,3 is something that you're familiar from four dimensions. It's exactly the Lorentz group in four dimensions.
Okay. Right.
But, okay, let's not confuse that.
What about the higher n?
Well, they satisfy it with a sort of algebra. Sorry, they're with algebra.
Okay. But
this is a subalgebra of transformation.
Yeah, right. But they're not made up of like, transitions and rotations and scaling and.
No.
I guess there's no intuition we can attach to that.
Well, the intuition is that you get Z and you shift it by Z to the 27.
Okay.
That's the best you can do. Yeah, so that's why I mean, conformal transformation are not the most intuitive things, and let alone this, the higher one.
Okay.
More questions? Okay, so now we're after the quantum numbers for our conformal fields, which we know we have to specify the Lorentz quantum numbers and the dilatation quantum numbers. But something that's very nice in two dimensions is that it will be much more convenient for us to diagonalize operators So what we're going to do is diagonalize operators. Under L0 and L0 bar. And we will call the eigenvalues H. So the eigenvalue under L0, we'll call it H. And the eigenvalue under L0 bar is H bar. H bar, even though it looks a bit confusing, need not be X conjugate, okay? So that means that in this language, the usual spin quantum number and the scale quantum number can just be written as spin is H minus H bar, and delta, which the dimension is H plus H bar. And this just follows from this. Okay? So when we write the conformal transformations of operators, we will write them, we will exchange, we will change a bit the language we were using before. Instead of using delta and S, we will write it in terms of a completely equivalent set of quantum numbers. They contain exactly the same information. I can just invert this equation. So in terms of H and H bar, and you'll see why. Something that makes our life easier in two dimensions, which is not true in higher dimensions, is that in two dimensions, all Lorentz could be Euclidean representations are one-dimensional, and you can write them. And a nice basis to demonstrate this is that you can write an operator phi, and it will be I will transform in a one-dimensional representation, so there's not going to be this nasty matrix. It's just going to be multiplied by a number. It's going to be a field that's labeled by H. So we have a tensor. We'll have a whole bunch of lower indices. We'll have H holomorphic indices and H bar anti-holomorphic indices. And the point is that under a Lorentz transformation, you don't get out of this family. I mean, if you make a Lorentz transformation, you get back the same operator. This is very different than in higher dimensions. Let me give you an example. Let me give you a more pedestrian way of understanding this. I mean, it's very simple, but so let's think it just in terms of coordinates, okay? So in two dimensions, we have x1 and x2. So under a rotation, right? That's how a rotation acts on a two-dimensional space. And now the point is that, so it mixes the x1 component with the x2 component. That's the thing we're familiar with. If you make a rotation, you mix all the axes in your rotation. But now, if we use instead of x1 and x2 coordinates, we use z, which is x1 plus ix2, and z bar, which is x1 minus x2. What we find is that z goes to Z. I mean, you can do, and this is very simple to check. And Z bar goes to Z bar. So that means that in two dimensions, it's very remarkable that if I choose one axis of my rotation and I perform a rotation, it doesn't talk to the other axis, okay? This is completely different than in higher dimensions. If I give you the X3 axis in three dimensions and you perform a general rotation, X3 will change. But here, Z just you have something that has a z-index, you get on the other side something only with a z-index. And if you start with something with a z-bar index, you get something with a z-bar index here. And that's a statement that in two dimensions, Euclidean transformations are the representations are just one-dimensional. You just tell me the tensor structure of your operator or your tensor. And under the transformation, you get exactly the same object back with no funny matrices. It's not a linear combination of things, just the operator back. Was this clear? And notice that, yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, so now we are almost there to talk about what the conformal fields are. So a conformal primary so we make this kind of transformation. OK, the analog complex conjugate. So I'm not going to write all the indices explicitly here. But you see that by looking at the transformation rule of the tensor, you can infer how many of these guys and how many of those guys there are. So what we say is that phi of z and z bar transforms to phi tilde of w bar. And now we make just a transformation rule of a tensor. So if this is a tensor with such many lower holomorphic indices and so many anti-holomorphic indices, what you should get is to the power h, dz bar, w bar, to the power h bar, times phi of z bar. So notice that in two dimensions, things are much simpler. We'll make your life and my life easier, not to carry all these indices around. And before, as I said before, and we'll see it more explicitly now, so let's get some intuition about this transformation. So let's make a scale transform. Let's make the following transformation. Let's take omega to be lambda times z, where lambda is a complex number. So under this transformation, what we have is that phi tilde ww bar equals lambda to the minus h, lambda bar to the minus h bar. Okay, so here, let me write just lambda z and now we can read the various quantum numbers. I can parameterize lambda. Lambda is a complex number, so I can always write it as the magnitude of lambda times the phase. Which letter haven't I used? I haven't used alpha. So I can organize this as magnitude of lambda, and you get a contribution from this guy and this guy with the same sign, because under complex conjugation, the magnitude doesn't change. So from here you get h plus h bar. And from here you get a non-trivial phase. You get e to the minus I alpha h minus h bar, phi of z, z bar. And from here we recover what we knew, essentially, that essentially this, that by reading the exponent of multiplying the scale change, notice that this is the guy that changes the scale, this is the guy that has a non-trivial magnitude, we find that delta is just h plus h bar. And by looking at which phase you have acquired under this E1 rotation, you read the spin. So h minus h bar. Any questions about this?
I'll take just 2 more minutes, and then tomorrow we can start with word identities. To just spell out,
just say two kind of a couple of trivial things. Also, I think I should say is that in two dimensions, it will be important to distinguish two types of primaries. There are going to be primaries that transform like that, so A. We call primaries operators that transform like that for any W of Z, for any of the infinite number of conformal transformations. It will be useful to define the notion of a quasi-primary. So these are, again, operators that will transform this way, but only under a subset of the transformations, which are the globally defined ones. So under SO13 or under L0, L0, L1, L-1, L0 bar, L1 bar, L-1 bar. And this distinction is very important in two dimensions because we will see that in two dimensions, the kind of the fundamental operator in the theory, which is the stress energy tensor, in fact, it's not a primary operator, it's a quasi-primary operator. And this will have very important consequences for us. Okay, so the last thing I want to say is that you can easily work out what the infinitesimal transformation would be just by expanding this transformation to infinitesimal to leading order. And I just want to conclude with saying a couple of simple things about the stress tensor in two dimensions. So the stress tensor in two dimensions has three components, the symmetric matrix. And we can write it in complex coordinate. And we'll see that we will be playing with the stress tensor a lot from now on, kind of the key object. And we have there, so T has two indices, right? T mu, no? And you can write it in terms of these complex coordinates. So you can have either TZZ, TZ bar Z bar, or TZZ bar. Now we know, let's see what conformal symmetry tells us about this object, about these three components. So we know that it's traceless. And if you work it out, it's a trivial exercise, you will find that this implies that the ZZ bar component of the stress tensor has to vanish. Okay? And it's conserved. And this will imply that the anti-holomorphic derivative of TZZ has to vanish, and the holomorphic derivative of TZ bar Z bar has to vanish. So that means that instead of always keeping these indices, which, yes. Well, the metric in the Z bar coordinate is of diagonal, yeah. It's like light cone. When you write, the metric is just this, right? So, yes. In Lorentzian, it's just the metric in flat space, you can write it like that in two dimensions. So this equation tells us that T, which we'll take just to be the ZZ bar component, is holomorphic. So the stress tensor in two dimensions is a holomorphic object. It's killed, annihilated by Z bar, and T ZZ bar. So if you wish, we can write this as T as a function of Z. It doesn't depend on Z bar. And likewise, there's an anti-holomorphic stress tensor. So these two guys will be the Of course, these are the ones that generate conformal transformations. Remember that conformal transformations, like all space-time transformations, are generated by multiplying together the stress tensor with the corresponding vector field. And in the next lecture, so today I'll stop. In the next lecture, we will use the conserved currents associated to arbitrary conformal transformations to, in a way, eventually, not tomorrow, but eventually to completely solve the theory. Okay? So any questions before we leave? Okay, very good.